Well, this evening we're going to be starting a short series in the Old Testament book of Habakkuk. Now, Habakkuk is known as a minor prophet, and that's not because he is any way inferior to those who we know as major prophets, but simply because his book, as with all the other minor prophets, is that much more concise, much shorter than those major prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, for example. And that's the only difference, really, between a minor prophet and a major prophet. Just the size of their book. And because Habakkuk is only a short book, we're going to be covering it over the next three Sunday evenings. So please do come along to all three if you can. Because hopefully we'll see that it is a very practical book. Habakkuk, like many of us, is a man with a few nagging questions that he really needs some answers to. Before we take a look at the book of Habakkuk itself, I thought it might be useful to get an idea of the times in which it was written. A time when King Jehoiakim was king of Judah. So just to get a bit of historical background, just turn to 2 Kings, 2 Kings, chapter 23 and verse 31. 2 Kings, chapter 23. It's on page 397 of those blue Bibles. 2 Kings and chapter 23. It says there, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 3 months. His mother's name was Hamutal, daughter of Jeremiah. She was from Libna. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as his fathers had done. Pharaoh Necho put him in chains at Riblah, in the land of Hamath, so that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he imposed on Judah a levy of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah, and changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim. But he took Jehoahaz, and that was Jehoiakim's brother, and carried him off to Egypt. And there he died. Jehoiakim paid Pharaoh Necho the silver and gold he demanded. In order to do so, he taxed the land and exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land according to their assessments. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 11 years. His mother's name was Zebedah, daughter of Pedaiah. She was from Rumah. And he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as his fathers had done. During Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, invaded the land, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. But then he changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord sent Babylonian, Aramean, Moabite, and Ammonite raiders against him. He sent them to destroy Judah, in accordance with the word of the Lord, proclaimed by his servants, the prophets. Surely these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command, in order to remove them from his presence, because of the sins of Manasseh and all he had done, including the shedding of innocent blood. For he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. As for the other events of Jehoiakim's reign and all that he did, are they not written in the book of annals of the kings of Judah? Jehoiakim rested with his fathers, and then we're told that his son succeeded him as king. And we'll just begin by reading the first four verses, which begins, "The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen, or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous, so that justice is perverted." We all have questions, don't we? We asked them of parents and teachers. We put them to experts and professionals in various fields. We debate them with our friends and mull over them in quiet moments alone. But there are some questions that it seems no one is able to answer, not even the wisest of people. They are the big questions, questions of life and death, questions that cry out for a response. So is there anyone that we can turn to, anyone who can give us an answer? As Christians, there is someone who we can approach, and that someone is God. This is exactly what the prophet Habakkuk does. He has a number of questions that only God can answer. In fact, Habakkuk was an unusual prophet in this regard, because usually, as you'll know, it was the job of a prophet to speak to the people on God's behalf, to bring them his message and instruction for their lives. But in Habakkuk's case, he speaks to God on behalf of the people, and he brings his own questions and complaints before God. Just as Job, David, as well as the writers of the Psalms, among others, Habakkuk questions God. And this shows us that it's okay to do that. If we don't understand what's happening in the world, what's happening in our own lives, and where God is in all of this, then it's okay to be open and honest with him. It's true to say that we mustn't ever accuse God. We must never put God in the dock, as it were. But we can inquire of him. We can ask him questions and seek answers. It's not a sin to come to God and say, Lord, I know that you're good and that you're faithful, but I just don't understand. What's happening at the moment just doesn't make any sense. Why do you still allow suffering? Why is there so much injustice in the world? Why do Christians still sin? All big, relevant questions. And as we join Habakkuk, we find that at this point in his life, the questions he has are causing him to struggle, and his trust in God is being tested. But what I appreciate about Habakkuk is that in looking for answers, he doesn't turn to philosophical theories or empty religion. Habakkuk goes straight to God. And that's why he is such a great example for us all. If you have struggles, if you have troubles, if you have questions, then go to God. Pick up the Bible, read it, pray about it. Ask God to help you understand the situation. And just as God answered Habakkuk, he will surely answer you. Because you know, if you go anywhere else, the best we'll get is speculation, isn't it? Not revelation. We'll only get people-inspired opinions, but not God's answers. So what are Habakkuk's questions? Well, let's take a look. His first question is found in chapter 1, in the first part of verse 2. How long, O Lord, must I cry for help, but you do not listen? I wonder, have you ever felt as Habakkuk did? You've been praying about a particular issue or for a particular person, and it just seems as though your prayers aren't being heard, that they're hitting the ceiling and they're not going any further. God, are you there? Are you listening? We question. Deep down, we know that he is, because we know that he hears our prayers. We know that not even a sparrow falls to the ground without him noticing. And we also know that he's willing to answer our prayers if they're in accordance with his will. Well, here, Habakkuk sees sin and injustice all around him, and he thinks to himself, that's not right. So he prays and he asks God to do something about it. Surely God has to respond, he thinks to himself. After all, it can't be God's will for things to carry on like this. But despite his prayers, and it's obvious from this particular verse that he's been praying about this matter for some time, God just doesn't seem to be listening. And this silence causes Habakkuk to doubt. Maybe this is something that you're familiar with. You've been praying about something for a while, and yet the Lord doesn't seem to be interested. Then Habakkuk continues in the second part of verse 2, asking, "How long, O Lord, must I cry out to you? Violence, but you do not save." Interestingly, this word violence is the Hebrew word translated Hamas, which I'm sure rings a bell with all of us. The tactics of this modern-day terrorist organisation known as Hamas could well mirror the violence that was taking place around Habakkuk at that time. And Habakkuk cries out to God about this kind of violence he's witnessing. The wicked ruling over the vulnerable. The godless harming the godly. Crime, murder, mayhem. And yet God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. Why, O Lord? Why aren't you rescuing these victims? Why don't you intervene? Then in verse 3, he's got another question. Why do you make me look at injustice? Habakkuk is simply saying, I'm fed up with it. I'm sick of it. Why do I have to look at this stuff every day? Why can't you just take me to be with you right now so that I don't have to see it all? I wonder, have you ever thought like that? If you have, join the club. And as a result, you or I could find ourselves opting out of society altogether, couldn't we? Refusing to watch the news or pick up a newspaper. Refusing to let your kids go to school. Even hiding away in some sort of commune so that you don't have to take any notice of all the bad news and injustice that's going on. There's so much of it, so much doom and gloom, that in order to get us to tune in tomorrow night, the people at the news at 10 always seems to place a light-hearted news item at the end of their newscast, don't they? Have you ever noticed that? Something that restores your faith in human nature, such as the story of a man who risks his life to save a cat that's stuck on some power cables or something like that. And you think to yourself, oh, that's nice. There must be some good-hearted people out there. Maybe the world's not so bad after all. Maybe I'll give it all another go tomorrow. But by now, Habakkuk is fed up and he's frustrated. Why do you make me look at injustice, he asks. And then in verse 3, he adds, why do you tolerate wrong? You're a holy God. I'm an unholy sinner, Habakkuk is thinking. If this stuff, this violence and injustice matters to me, then why doesn't it matter to you? If I can't even look at it, then how can you put up with it? Surely this matters far more to you. So why aren't you doing anything about it? These are his questions. And then he explains the source of his frustration. Second part of verse 3. Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. This text is over 2,500 years old, and yet it reflects the way that things are still today, doesn't it? Sinful human beings haven't changed over the centuries. And a world that tries to leave God out of its thoughts and actions hasn't become any better. So we could say, as Habakkuk did, how long, O Lord, are you going to put up with all of this? Just last week, Mick Philpott, his wife, and a friend, having conspired to kill 6 innocent children while they lay fast asleep in bed, were found guilty of manslaughter. It seems that Philpott's desire for money and revenge drove him to instigate such a horrific crime. And yet he isn't the only one to have carried out such an evil deed. An estimated 1,500 people, 1,500 people are murdered around the globe every single day. And talk about injustice. Many of these murders go unnoticed, which means the murderers remain unpunished. And the cry goes out, "How long, O Lord?" Then there's North Korea with its increasing war rhetoric, which, even though it may only be a big show by a foolish young dictator, has left many people living in fear of what might happen. And that isn't the only part of the world that lives in fear. In fact, many nations are in the midst of conflict. Countries such as Syria, Mali, Afghanistan and Iraq, to name but a few. As a consequence, millions of people, having been driven out of their homes, are now trying to survive in refugee camps. And there and elsewhere, many face starvation because of the neglectful greed and indifference of others. And the cry continues, "How long, O Lord?" Having just taken a brief glimpse of the world around us, we can see that evil and problems abound. But then notice that Habakkuk is not just talking about nations in general. He's actually talking about God's nation in particular, the nation of Israel. The equivalent today, I suppose, is the church. And there are many things happening under the guise of the church that makes us ask the same question. God, how long are you going to put up with all of this? Abuse scandals involving various church leaders have sadly become regular news. Then there's the watering down of God's word on issues such as homosexuality and hell by people who should know better, Steve Chalk and Rob Bell. Not to mention the ongoing persecution of Christians around the world, leaving many families struggling because they've had either loved ones thrown into prison or killed for their faith. Why does God allow this kind of thing to carry on? Why doesn't he step in and do something about it? Especially when his own name and reputation is at stake. These are the kind of perplexing questions that we might find ourselves asking. They're certainly the kind of questions that Habakkuk is asking God with regards to the nation of Israel. So what's God's response? That was the prophet Habakkuk's question to God, wasn't it? How long, O Lord, are you going to put up with this injustice and violence within Israel and beyond? When are you going to listen to my prayers and do something about it? Now listen to God's response again from the first chapter of Habakkuk, from verse 5. "Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honour. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own strength is their God." Well, like Habakkuk, we often want God to answer our questions. We want him to intervene. But I wonder, are we actually ready for his response? You see, God's reply to Habakkuk comes as a real shock. In verse 5, God says, "Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed, for I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told." "I've heard your prayers," God is saying to Habakkuk, "and I'm at the end of my patience as well. If you hate people's sin, if it upsets you, then think about what it's like for me, a holy and righteous God. I can't stand sin. I can't even have it in my presence." God may have even thought to himself that this kind of sin is eventually going to cost my son his very life. "I hate sin. I detest it. And now it's time to do something about it. So this is my plan," verse 6. "I'm raising up the Babylonians." The Babylonians. Habakkuk must have taken a step back at this point. "Yes, God," says, "that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to forcibly take what's not their own." The Babylonians were a fearsome people, a godless nation who trusted in nothing but themselves. And God is going to use them to punish his chosen people. It's as though God is saying to Israel, "If you want to carry on ignoring me and my ways, then this is what you're going to end up like. Meet the Babylonians. If you try and run away from them, they'll catch you. Their horses are swifter than leopards. They are faster than you, so you won't get away. What's more, they are like ferocious wolves hunting in packs, and nothing will get in the way of what they want. They're certainly not into negotiating. If they want your house, they'll take it. And if you stand in the way, then they'll kill you. They fly like a vulture, swooping to devour. They all come bent on violence." You might think to yourself, "Oh, I'll be okay. They won't get me. Besides, there are far too many of us for that. I'll just hide in a corner somewhere." What about? Verse 9 tells us that there are loads more of them, hordes of them, in fact. "And they gather prisoners like the sand." "Well, I'm important. I've got status. They'll spare me." No, they won't. The Babylonians don't care what your status is. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. Then you might think that you're safe because you live in a city with big walls and an army guarding it. But as we see in verse 10, they laugh at all fortified cities. They know exactly how to get into a walled city. They'll go over the top. They'll build a ramp up against the walls and they'll get in that way. This means you're like sitting ducks with no way of escape. You're trapped. The Babylonians were a ruthless people. And as we can see, there was nothing that anyone could do to stop that. Such is God's judgment on the wicked. And what about the Israelites? Well, they have been lulled into a false sense of security. Thinking that they were untouchable and could do what they liked, they thought that ignoring God's laws wouldn't matter, that there wouldn't be any consequences. In this respect, they were like many people today, maybe even Christians, who repeat the same sin time and time again, not realizing that God is watching. And here God is saying to Habakkuk, "I've heard your prayers, and I'm sick of it too. So this is what I'm going to do. Here's some justice." Do we like God's response? Did Habakkuk? We'll discover exactly what his reaction was next week. As for us, let's admit it. Deep down, we think that we're relatively good people compared to those other people, compared to the Babylonians of this world. They're the ones who should be punished, not us. So can't we just have a telling off from God instead? Yet the reality is this. No matter who we think we are all sinners. And God is extremely patient with every one of us. Up until now, God has been stopping the Babylonians attacking his chosen nation, like a dam holding back a mighty river. God has been patient. But instead of turning to him, Israel has become more wicked. And giving them more time just isn't going to help them. They are mocking God. And so it's time for him to bring about his justice. You know, it's interesting to note, isn't it, that Habakkuk has become so frustrated and sick of sin, so much so that he seems ready to act before God does. Do you notice that? So what does that tell us about God? Well, I think it goes to show just how long-suffering God is. As humans, we're impatient, aren't we? We want justice straight away. We want to see God act. But we need to remember that God's thoughts are not our thoughts and his ways are not our ways. In his second letter, the Apostle Peter writes in chapter 3 and verse 9 that the Lord is not slow in keeping his promises, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. God's delay, you see, is intended to give people an opportunity to repent. It's not that God isn't angry with sin and injustice. It's not that he's refusing to punish the wicked. He will. But it's all going to be done in his sovereign time and in his sovereign way. Alistair Begg, a pastor who greatly encouraged me personally when I spoke to him at a conference several years ago, says this. He says, when people ask us as Christians, why isn't your God doing something? We need to learn to say that this God of ours has done something and tell them the story of the cross. We need to be able to say that this God of ours is going to do something and show them the bar of his judgment. And we need to be able to say that the God of the Bible is doing something. That he is showing kindness to those who deserve his wrath in order to give them time to come to him in repentance. Because as Peter said, our God is not slow as some understand slowness. The fact is, there is a very good reason for his delay. I'm sure that down through the centuries, God has had many people asking him to bring about his judgment and justice at that particular moment in time. Just as Habakkuk prayed and prayed and prayed for it. But God is patient. And as he looks ahead, he can see those people who he still has to save. Those who he still needs to bring into his family. Can you, for instance, imagine if God had granted one of those prayer requests to stretch out his mighty arm of justice before you became saved? If you are saved, that is. What if God had intervened before he got round to saving you? And that's why, in a sense, we need to put up with this sin-sick world around us. To live in it and yet not get squeezed into its mould. Because God is holding back the day of his judgment for a reason. And that reason is that there are still some lost sheep that need finding and bringing home. And that's where you and I come in. If you've been saved by the grace and mercy of God, then even as you continue to struggle with your own questions, you can point to a God who holds all the answers. A God who can give people hope, not only in this life, but also in the life to come. A God who doesn't just stand back with his arms folded, doing nothing about the sin of this world, but who came in the person of Jesus Christ. He's the one who took on flesh and went to the cross to die in our place, for our sin as a perfect substitute, and then rose again so that we could have new life if we will only place our trust in him. You know, once you are saved by God, and once you do become a new creation, like Habakkuk, you will be frustrated by the sin that you see all around you, and by the sin that still remains within your own heart. But you'll be able to look forward to a day when, because of what Christ has done, you will be made perfect and able in the righteousness of Christ to stand before God's glorious throne. In the meantime, be patient and use every opportunity you have to tell others the good news of Christ, crucified, risen, and coming again.